Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Amy Elizabeth. She's an entrepreneur, photographer and teacher based in the USA who develops film soup, makes self-portraits and runs her own podcast. So is just the sort of busy, creative person that I like to get on the show. As you'll hear, her creativity is also grounded in supporting her family practically as well as nourishing her creatively. This was a fantastic conversation. I hope you enjoy learning more about Amy Elizabeth. You appear to have reams and reams of 35mm. Like it's like if I was set dressing you for the movie, I would have film in the background. It's kind of perfect.
Well, maybe I should have started by saying, welcome to Film Lab 135, because this is client film hanging behind me in it is organized chaos, but I have a system that works. And so this green covered thing that you can see is my scanner. And this is film that I have scanned and maybe have delivered, maybe need to package up to ship back. Maybe need to toss it, but I like to wait a few days just in case. And there's more film in the basement that's hanging. And so, yes, this is my constant background. And it is very fitting. I think it sets the tone of we are talking about film. We are creative. We are a little bit chaotic. We're not super organized. And by we, I mean me. And yeah, so that is the background, which is a great segue.
How long have you run the lab for?
I started it. So the lab I run, Film Lab 135, is really dedicated mostly to processing experimental film, namely film soup, which if somebody's not familiar with film soup, all it really is you shoot your film and then you throw it into maybe a mason jar or a pot and you pour on boiling water or boiled water, and then you just kind of go into your kitchen and find what you can. So maybe lemon juice and or vinegar and or salt and or baking soda, or sometimes people will find flowers or herbs or different things and just put it right in there and make a soup, and it messes with the emulsion. And so you don't want to send it to a quote unquote normal lab. You want to send it to a lab that will accept your film, because you don't want your messed up film affecting other people's film. And so that is what Film Lab 135 specializes in. And other people will send other experimental type film, or sometimes I'll even get people sending in their really vulnerable self-portrait film to me, because I have not sent my film to a lab to be developed in a long time. And I can only imagine how vulnerable it is to send your self-portraits film to somebody else, to be the first to develop and scan it and send it back to you. And kudos to all of you. I think that is a vulnerable step that I don't have to take, and I have the luxury of not taking. And so sometimes I will get people like, I wanted to send these to you because I know that you get it and you're not going to judge. And I'm like, what an honor. What an absolute honor. So I started the lab. I hadn't forgotten your question. I just, as I do with my brain, nothing is linear, but I will hopefully circle back to all of the questions. During the pandemic, I was taking, I had three kids at the time. I still have three kids, but I had all three of my kids at that time. And we weren't doing the playground thing. Playgrounds were shut down. What do you do with three boys too in a small home? And so we started taking the same walk twice a day, every day. And that was it. So besides being in the home, we would take the same stupid walk twice a day. And I was yearning for creativity. And I was really in this like boom of shooting film. I had gotten my scanner maybe a couple years before. I had learned how to develop my own film a couple years before. And I was shooting like 10 rolls a month or something. Like, this was just in my, I want to learn all there is to know about film phase. And how do you do that when you are just so uninspired by taking the same walk twice a day? And I encourage people to go out and be a tourist in their own city. I think it's really fun to go and take on the mundane and try to find it in a new light. We don't always have to take vacations to be inspired, but it is really difficult when you are feeling constrained. So I started embracing film soup because I had done it before, but I really started embracing it. And it felt like this metaphor for everything we were going through, because when you soup your film, you never really know what's going to happen. And you feel a little out of control, but it's this thing that you kind of are controlling. And so it gives you this sense of control, but it's also very chaotic and unpredictable, but there's beauty in it. And as an artist, that is something that I really try to cling to, is the beauty in life amidst the grief and the sadness and the loss and the frustrations and the disappointments. Is I always try to look for the beauty, and that's what my art is aimed at doing. And it, so film soup just felt like it was doing that. And I was able to embrace the chaos and embrace the beauty amidst all of this. And it gives you a little control. You're like, the one thing I can, you know, I can control my art. That's like the thing I can control. Nothing else. I, you know, ultimately cannot, you know, I'm not going to control my kids. I'm going to parent them, but I'm not going to control them. I'm not making decisions for the state of the city, the country, the world. I'm at the whim of people who are doing the best they can with what they have, whether I disagree or agree. And so it felt like something I could control and yet embrace the unexpected, the unknown. So I felt such a gratitude for film soup because of that. And I know that at that time, I didn't know of any labs that took film soup. And I had a scanner. I developed my own film, you know, by hand. And so I don't have machinery I have to worry about, or, you know, I'm not developing people's wedding photos. Like, it's, I'm just developing my own film. And so I felt that as something to give to the film community, it would be opening this lab where people could send me their film. And it has always really just been a passion project. It is something that does bring in money, but because it's such a manual process, and so it just, and I'm running everything, it's definitely, I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it mostly as a passion project that people compensate me for. I opened it September 1st of 2020. And here we are 4.5 years later, and it's still going. And people are still embracing film soup, and I still get lots of film. I mean, I think last year I was like maybe around 600 rolls of film, which, you know, it's one of my many prongs, I think you called it, but legs or something of my business. And so it's a lot. But it is awesome. And it's so great when people get excited. They're like, I'm so excited I found you. And, or like, you know, thank you so much for processing this. Or I was, you know, I've heard like, I was so dissatisfied with my film soup, and then I found your lab and I'm like re-energized again. And so it's a wonderful way to kind of give to the film community and be connected with artists and empower artists, which is really the heart of everything I do.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Like, to have something that I like what you're saying there about giving something back to a community. It's very much the same with a podcast. You know, you kind of make something, you get feedback from people, you feel like you're gradually becoming part of a wider thing. You're definitely not doing it for the money. It's, you know, it is loss making in my case, but I do have a few people who try and support, and they like pay for the hosting. So I think that's kind of how I feel like I know I'm doing something good, I hope, because of the way that people react to it and respond to it, rather than, you know, and the feeling of making something. So to be honest, I'm very fortunate that I have a day job. This doesn't have to sustain me or support me. I think my approach to it would be somewhat different if it did, but the fact that I can get, the value I get is from the value of making something. And then a bit like you being trusted, it's wonderful when someone reaches out and goes, I really love this thing that either you do, or that you made, or that you've enabled me or inspired me. Like, I've had messages from people who've picked up a camera again for the first time in ages in part because they found the podcast and they started listening because they historically liked photography. And it's wonderful. And they're hearing people like you and other guests. And they're like, yeah, I could do that again. You know, there will be a film soup email that comes my way now, probably, you know, it's wonderful.
I love it. Empowering other artists. It's such a satisfying thing for those of us that really feel that call. And yeah. So it's always wonderful when your work, I'm a words of affirmation person, and I mm-hmm. actually make that really well known on my Instagram stories, like, send me your words, because they keep me going. And yeah. So I don't know if you're a words of affirmation person, but it's like those words really do a lot to keep you going and say, okay, if I'm affecting one person,
yeah,
that's like all I need. And that's how you know, like, you're doing the good work.
Yeah. I grew up watching Quantum Leap. I have a strong belief in the impact of one person on the impact of the next person, and those lives touch other lives and stuff. Like, it's not bunkum. It's not hokum. It's a really important message that, like, that's how people support each other and what we should do. So when you were doing that then, was that the natural progression? Because it seems to me now, having got your 30 days of self-portraits and starting to work a little bit with that myself and, like, really enjoying it and sort of very much pushing myself outside my comfort zone, but it's a really good thing, I think, to try and do. That feels like a very logical, natural progression then, if that's your starting point, to continue to support people in different ways.
So I do feel like it is. And I have the heart of a teacher, I would say. I went to school for math, and then I ended up going on to get my teaching license, and I taught high school math for 5 years before having my first kid. And it turns out I'm just a lot more introverted than I realized. I have a lot of energy, and it maybe shocks people. They'll be like, are you sure you're introverted? And I'm like, absolutely. Like, I love giving my energy to people, but I do get drained very easily. And I need to be by myself to recharge. And I just knew having a kid at home or a baby at home. And then I had, you know, two more relatively soon after that, it wasn't sustainable for me to be in the classroom, giving my energy to all these other kids, and then come home to my own and have nothing left. But there's so much about teaching high school math that I loved. And I loved when kids would say, I hated math before, or I could never do it before. And it's like, you know, but now I feel confident, or now I want to be a math teacher, or I'm going to go on to be an accountant. Yeah. And so empowering people and helping kind of demystify things that feel unapproachable, because math is, I believe, it's a lot more approachable than we're led to believe. Yeah. And so demystifying it and empowering people has always been something that has given me great joy. So teaching has always been part of who I am. And in 2000, I want to say 18, I was kind of like one of the first people asked to be a contributor for a website called Shoot It With Film. And it is a great resource for film photographers learning new techniques, or, you know, finding inspiration. And so I joined. And so once every 2 months, I was charged with the task of writing an article, which was wonderful, because then it also meant, you know, I love deadlines because it forces us to do things. And it made me get a lot of things off my mental Pinterest board, as I call it, and actually do the darn thing. Yep. And then in 2020, I started my film lab. And then soon after that, we started Shoot It With Film Insiders, which was a monthly subscription group for film photographers who wanted a little more intentional community and hands-on education. And that was a way for me to be able to teach. I was doing the educational content and the videos, and I was teaching the techniques, and that for me was just a natural progression. And that kind of ran its course after a couple years, but the teaching never left. So you can, you know, take the teacher out of the classroom, but can't take the classroom out of the teacher, if that makes any sense, but we're going to run with that. And what had happened by that point is I ended up becoming separated from my ex-husband and going through a divorce process. And in that process, you know, I had mostly been a stay-at-home mom. I had also helped him. He was a pastor and I was, you know, professional volunteer. I was leading worship. I was hosting people in our home. I was on leadership teams. I was doing a lot. So between what I was doing with Shoot It With Film, some of the portrait sessions I had, being a homemaker, and then being, you know, my ex's like kind of right-hand person, that's all I had time for. And so what do you do when you leave a marriage and now your whole, so much of my identity was wrapped up in being a pastor's wife and kind of serving the church and being part of the church. And, but ultimately, like, we live in a capitalistic society. And so I couldn't just be like, oh, now I'm going to care for my kids. You have to actually make money. And, you know, people are like, are you going to go back to teaching? And I was like, there's so much I love about teaching, but ultimately, like, this phase of my life is about saying, what makes me happy? What do I want to do? And being a high school math teacher, just, I've learned, you know, as I've learned more about myself, it's not a good fit. And, but what is a good fit? You know, who knows? But ultimately, I am a creative person. Photography has been a love of mine since the high school darkroom. I had already established myself as somebody who knows something in the film space. And I love empowering people. And so I just remember talking with my therapist and admitting to her, I want to like try to make a business out of all of this. And that felt so scary, right? When you're like, when you finally admit it. And the craziest thing happened. She didn't make fun of me or say, you can't do it. She actually was like, then that's what you should do. And as I started saying that to friends, same. They didn't make fun of me. They didn't try to tell me how impractical it was, which is absolutely, you know, what the message that I would get from my parents growing up. You know, part of the reason I majored in math is because it's practical and everything is for the sake of practicality. And what I wanted to do felt so impractical and still kind of does. Like, I look at it and I'm like, I can't believe I think this is going to work. And sometimes I don't, but I'm like, I still have to keep going. And so I just started building my business out of that, out of what I had already established and what brought me joy and where I feel like my gifts lie. And so that's led me to this point, I guess.
There's a stat, and obviously all stats are made up, but I read something recently that it was around someone's third business is the one typically that actually does something and takes off. Like, you have a few false starts. And the reason it rang true was I was reading it and I realized this is the third time I've tried to do some sort of podcasty style creative project. And so suddenly I was like, ah, right, no, this one works. But I think the other thing you're mentioning there, which obviously I'm an old school project manager professionally, right? That's my background. And what you described as a mother of boys, I've got two under, well, one's 11 soon, chaos in the most beautiful way. I spoke to a friend's wife earlier on. She posted a picture on Instagram of her son's shoes where the sole is coming away from the upper of the shoe. And she didn't have this problem with her daughter. And she's just like, is this, and she posted, she was like, is this normal for parents of boys? And I just replied going, yes.
Yes.
this is absolutely going to happen again. As someone who has had to replace, put the coat hangers back up on the wall in the porch for the second time this week, because you know what, Amy, they just fell off. I don't know if you know that.
They just
these things that are held into the wall with like three screws and are like solid. And you're like, no, they just fall off apparently. So it is funny that you're organized. Right, you're clearly good at getting stuff done. You're good at bringing people together. So of course, it's natural that actually you would be able to make a success of these things. And what's fantastic, it sounds like, is that nobody around you said, ooh, I don't know about that. Because they did to me when I was younger. Like, people were very, I think I've taken a longer time to find this. And I think there's a there's an old thing. When I was growing up, you were like maths and science, or you were creative. And there was this, I think lie is too strong a word, but theory peddled at us by those who were, you know, older and supposed to know better, that you couldn't be both and you had to pick one. At school especially, you had to go down like a science track or down an arts track. And there was a general sense that the arts track was less valuable. And what are you doing if you've got a degree in, like, I have a degree in Scottish literature, right? Which my folks, I'm sure, were not thrilled at the notion. Not only has he done literature, he's done literature for a country of less than 10 million people, or whatever, you know, whatever it was. And so, but I love it and I live here now, and it's, you know, it's incredible. I was born here, so I like, I've come back to it. But it, but it's that thing of we tell people the wrong thing almost. And actually, you are an example, which is why I was so interested in the fact that your creativity very obviously says people have got to get paid. I did some work with a charity 20 years ago. It was a bunch of people who'd done War Child, were starting a new one called No Strings, right? And the thing that surprised me when I was working with them was that right in the first meeting, they sat everyone down who was giving their time to this thing professionally. Like, I was building the website, some people were doing some other stuff. They were, you know, they sat us all down and were like, this has to work for all of you. There's like and there was a very clear, commercially, everyone has to get something out of this in terms of exposure or whatever. Otherwise, it's just not worth, you know, like, otherwise your support won't be able to be sustained because you can't survive on, you know, like, oh, you'll get exposure. Oh, nice. Can I eat that?
I know, exposure is the worst.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, no, I think it's amazing to hear you talk so, like, clearly about it. It makes perfect sense standing back for it now. I imagine at the time it felt like building the aeroplane on the way down off the cliff.
It still feels that way a lot. I mean, I'm a couple years in. I mean, I started Film Lab, and that was kind of like one of those things where you see as you're leaving your, I mean, I was married for almost 18 years, and you know, my identity was wrapped up in that marriage. And it's, you know, I've had, and now subsequently I've had other friends kind of end up leaving their marriages. Mm. And you look back and you see kind of these provisions, these things that lined up to kind of help you as you are standing in the rubble and trying to rebuild. And for me, having started Film Lab as a passion project, I see the ways that that really provided me with what I, kind of something I needed to have, something where it's like, this consistently brings in something every month. And it varies, of course, because it's a lab, but I know it's going to bring in more than zero. And that's kind of what I needed. And, you know, as I'm moving forward, like, I'm still figuring it out, you know, as is right now. Is it sustainable for the long run? No. But am I building something that I believe in and I'm seeing success in? Yes. And so I'm still, I think as an entrepreneur though, I think you're always building the plane as you take off. And I do think that learning to live in that kind of continual adaptation phase, I'm learning that I'm gonna have to get used to that uncertainty and thrive in it, because you have to, you know, you have to be able to pivot. You have to be able to say what is working, what isn't, how can I change this? How can I take feedback and grow? What are the things maybe I need to cast off? What are the things I need to take on? And as somebody who has a history of anxiety, I think learning to live like this is really uncomfortable. But also, I think there's healing work that's being done in saying, I get to learn. Ultimately, I'm learning to trust myself and trust my gifts and my strengths and to lean into the calling that I am hearing. And learning to trust myself has been the hardest healing of all. But I've really kind of thrust myself into it. And I think that helps me, has helped me, will continue to help me grow and kind of become the best version of me that I can be.
Yeah, and presumably feeds nicely into the creative work itself as well, because a lot of what you've been passionate about and encouraging others to take up is self-portraiture, which can be another one of those kind of things that people resist or find hard because it could be uncomfortable and they're worried about how they feel about themselves. But it sounds, from listening to your podcast and from reading stuff you've written about it, it sounds like that's been an incredible thing for you to just open you up, you know, to accepting more.
Absolutely. And it was toward the end of my marriage that I kind of started, it was like a compulsion to take self-portraits. And after my kids would go to bed, I found myself kind of in my little basement studio with my strobe and my backdrop. And I couldn't figure out why it was a compulsion. I mean, other than the fact that I really do have ADHD. And so hyper-focus and really diving into things is just what I do. It's what I do. But like, why self-portraits? And it was later on that I was doing this visualization exercise with our marital therapist. And it was through that exercise that I realized, oh, I'm learning to see myself. And that's why this compulsion is here. And it's true. And I think once again, something that, you know, I think one of my superpowers is when I get excited about something, I want to share it with others and get them excited too. So film soup, you know, I was excited about it. It was saving me and I wanted to give that to others. Self-portraits, same thing. I got excited about it because I could see how much it was actually impacting me and helping me to see myself and express things and process things. And so I wanted to give that gift to others. And so I've run some workshops and I have a free download, 30 days of self-portraits that walks you through. I've done a live run of it last year where we worked through it together because I love doing things in community. I think that's the best way to do those things. And yeah, it's powerful to pass along something that's been a gift for me and help people become more vulnerable. Like, I think so much, and you know, I am absolutely learning to become more vulnerable. It's really hard. It just always is, because that's the definition of vulnerability. But the more we can tap into it, I think the better a world we have if people are able to be vulnerable with themselves and others. I think it builds community because it makes us feel less alone. It really gives us honest jumping off points for conversations. It's like, you can't have a deep relationship with a partner, a friend, a whatever, if you're not a therapist, if you're not vulnerable. And connection is really what we're all about. Like, that's the purpose of it all. And so vulnerability helps you connect. And so to kind of pass that along and help empower people to tap into that is just a great joy.
Yeah. I really like it, but I've conducted sort of experiments and I have an idea for a project. And it's, what's nice is that, and I talk about this a lot on the show with other guests, about iteration cycles and trying and repetition are so important to creative work. It's how we get good at things. And I think it's interesting that right back at the beginning, when you were talking about going on that walk every day, you realize that things change. I do that all the time, walking the boys to school and stuff, right? I have my camera with me every time I leave the house. And the practice on the days when it's the same means that on the days when it isn't the same, that you are doing something, you're ready, right, for when something does stand out. Yeah, you know? And so the self-portrait thing is fascinating, because we sometimes worry we don't have stuff to photograph, and that stops us picking up the camera. And I think one of the things that's really, really useful about a project like that is that you don't need a subject, you don't, other than yourself, you don't need to ask anyone else's permission. If you're picking up a camera for the first time in a while, or maybe the first time ever, you can practice. There was an exhibition in Sweden that I saw last year of self-portrait, like the history of the selfie. It was great. And so I think there's real power and value in it. And I don't know, the reason it stood out to me was because I don't see many people talking about it. very much as a, you know, there's lots of landscape photography. Street photography, oh my word, if you watch YouTube, you would think that street photography was the only form of photography. Ever. Yeah. This camera's perfect for the street, hashtag everyday carry, right? Like, yeah. It's everywhere. So I think it's nice to expand that and continue to sort of explore that. Do you think you'll take that further and continue to run the workshops and things with it? Do you have other kind of forms that you want to run little projects about? Because you also ship, which I love. You're an artist that ships rather than an artist that noodles. You set yourself, you were talking about it on the podcast this week.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, will it be, right, I'm going to be a specialist in this thing and I can see depth to that? Or do you go, are you looking at this and going, this is a block now, a bit of teacher brain. Now I can apply this block to landscape or macro or, you know, something else.
Yeah. And that's a really good question. Because I have noticed, I mean, I haven't honestly, like, it's wild. This year, 2025, we are a few months in. I have barely shot any film. I think maybe I have started and completed one roll of film the entire year, and it was in a point and shoot. So it was off the cuff. Whereas, as I stated, you know, 2020, 2021, 2019, I was shooting 10 plus rolls a month. And so there's clearly a change afoot, you know. Do I need to do more self-portraits? Absolutely. Just for myself, just as a, there's stuff I need to process. I need to get in front of the lens. I need to keep going. But I've also found that I am taking a lot of older pictures and reworking them. And so now I've, like, my latest kick is cyanotypes. And also kind of like a collage or multimedia. I don't know how you want to call it, like weaving things together or just smashing things together, or I don't know what else I'm doing, you know, embroidery, or, you know, and I'm taking these prints and I'm making things into prints. I'm taking these prints, I'm doing things with them. And that has also been really satisfying, just because I am a hands-on person and I don't have a dark room right now. I do have 5 enlargers in my basement, but no dark room yet. But I find that printing cyanotypes has been really rewarding, and it gives me something physical to work with. And like growing up, that's what I did. I did, you know, I was one of those classic people where it's like, you name the hobby, I had it. Like stamping, knitting, crochet, friendship bracelet making, anything you name it, I probably did it. And that's all with the hands. And there is something really satisfying about using your hands to create something that just does get lost in this digital world. And creating something from start to finish it does something that is just, you can't really reproduce in the digital. It's satisfying. And so that is my latest kick, and it is working with old pictures, which is also something of like a therapeutic activity in its own way, of saying that thing that I took isn't done. I can still use it to say something new, to approach it from a different way. And so I do think that, I don't know if that is adding depth to it, or, I mean, I think it's, you know, it is taking it and reworking it, is doing something. I would say it does do something different that feels very anti this day and age, in that Instagram has taught us. I actually think, and here I love Instagram. It has done a lot of wonderful things. It has connected me with people, which I've already stated, I think is the point of everything. But I do think there's two sides to the coin. One of the things it tells us is that you put something out there, it lives for 24 hours, and then it dies. And as artists, like, we can't believe that. Otherwise, it's really depressing. And we don't flow all the time. So we can't, it's not realistic to say, I am going to have 7 things every week, five things every week, whatever, that I want to share until the end of time. Like, it's a lie. On the other hand, it does keep us creating and saying, you know, what can I put out next? And I think that is, you know, there's always two sides to the coin, but it is a lie that things should just be made for a 24-hour time span. And so revisiting old work is something I think we should be doing, whether or not we do anything with it, just to even have fresh eyes on something we've created. A lot of times we will find beauty in something we had discarded, or yeah, you might be able to rework it and say, all right, this image, what does it mean now? What can I say with it now? And I think I love things that span time and space. I think that's what art does. It spans time and space. And it is kind of another way to re-engage with old work and even for yourself have it span time and space, which I think is just a cool thing.
It really is. And it reminds me of, have you read a book? I think the author is Austin Kleon. It's called Steal Like an Artist.
I haven't read that. No, I should.
Dead good. It's dead good. It's very short. It's kind of pamphlety and pithy. And there's some great quotes and stuff in there. There's the John Cleese one that I really love about creativity being a way of being or a way of operating. Specifically, the word operating, I think, is the word that I really like in that, because it takes away this notion that, like, oh, Monty Python was Monty Python because they were wildly creative and touched by genius. And it's like, well, they just worked stupidly hard at it for a really long time, you know. But there's a great thing in that, the concept of stock and flow. That as an artist or as someone creating anything, you have stock, podcast episodes, guides, PDF. These are stock. They are as useful a couple of years from now as they are at the time that you make them. Like, to someone who's discovering them for the first time, your past images are stock. And then there's flow. And the flow is when you're in the mindset and suddenly you have the idea and you're feeling hyper creative and you're like, this, I can see the thing before it happens. Scott Evans, previous guest of the show, he's not gone up yet, but he will by the time this goes out, time travel. Scott talked about the same thing of, you know, he's creating stuff, and it's that idea of if you will put stuff out when it's ready and you have these projects, you can see it in your head. You can see that it's going to work, and then there's a little bit of, because you know you're prepared, you know, going in, and then there's a little bit of the magic that happens when you're there in the moment working with someone, if it's a shoot like that, or when you're, you know, you'll surprise yourself, or you find the angle, or you find that, you know, you go in when you're experimenting, and that's where the flow comes into it. Yeah, I think you'd really enjoy that book.
I think I would. I know it's been one of those that, you know, is in the...
Yeah, people talk about it. It's floating
air,
around.
But
yeah, yeah.
It's around. I know it's there. And I really love that idea. I love some of the things you just touched on, because I do think that we have this notion that certain people are just creative. And it's like, no, you have to just show up consistently and do the really unglamorous work and just keep showing up. And eventually innovation happens, and it usually happens. Innovation, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And I think a lot of times it takes getting to a state of boredom to innovate. So, like, for instance, my boredom with my walk every day forced me to innovate. I've started doing Cyanotype Sunday, where I invite anyone who wants to join and create cyanotypes. And it's more just like, you know, on people's weekends when they probably have the time. And doing the same thing over and over and over, eventually you start to iterate on that. And so it takes showing up and getting to a point where maybe you're like boring yourself and you're like, how can I make this more fun? And I don't think we talk about that enough. We have to like be bored a lot of times before we will innovate and say, what else can I do? Because now I've kind of mastered this, let's move on. You have to be intentional. You have to intentionally show up. I don't want to say day after day, but, you know, week after week, month after month, whatever it is, in order for that lightning to strike. You can't like sit in your house doing nothing and expect lightning to strike you. You have to like go outside and kind of seek out that storm and be really intentional. So, which, you know, maybe it got a little morbid there, but like you have to be really intentional. And that's a big part of the reason I started the Art Lab, which is the monthly subscription group that I run for artists. And I think the word artist is such a scary word. I like couldn't even call myself a photographer until I was what, 36? And I had fallen in love with photography in my high school darkroom. Like, how is that for imposter syndrome? And just within the last few years, I'm like, no, I can call myself an artist. It might make me uncomfortable, but I'm going to. And so it is a calling to step into that title for people. Mm-hmm. And it's saying, here's a space for you to show up. You have deadlines, because we a lot of times need deadlines. Otherwise, like I said, things sit on my mental Pinterest board. And, you know, you do the work, you learn about the thing, you gather with other people, and you're going to create something every month that you would not have if you wouldn't have been in this group showing up. And for some people, it's just their way of saying, oh, I've had this idea forever that I just haven't done. And it's like, finally, this gave them the impetus to do it. And I think that is the best, because that was probably going to sit unrealized in their brain for who knows how long. You know, people will look at other people who are doing something successful and they'll be like, I had that idea. And it's like, yeah, having the idea is light years away from executing on the idea. It's like, you can't even compare the two. And so anytime ideas are realized, I think that's like the best thing we can do, is just realize those ideas. So
when the danger of saying I could have done that, I think is the like people looking at a Rothko, you know, and going, totally. Well, I could have done that. It's like, you didn't though, did you? This, no. You know, in the National Gallery, they used to have like this room full of Rothkos a few years back. And it was great. I remember when my eldest son, he must have been about 4 or 5, we went to Tate Modern, and they had some Rothkos, and they also had Monet water lilies, one of the really big ones, on loan. And what was brilliant was there's a bunch of adults, slightly, you know, we're all walking very sedately through, you know, in an art gallery, you're trying to be respectful. And Lewis just walks in, just goes, wow. And I was like, yes, that is the response. Yeah. And everybody turns and everybody smiles. And it's this kind of this moment. Because I think we as parents, especially of young children, and I have to kind of try and hold on to this, we get reminded daily the power and importance of being bored, right? Because actually getting bored then means they go and rediscover the thing they haven't touched for weeks, or they suddenly build things. And I think we as adults have too many fidget spinners, phones, Instagram things. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking to Jess about this the other day, that like I work in video games, so when I play video games, that's a useful thing that I'm doing for my work. But now, because of the podcast, and, you know, I've been doing this for a year, I play a lot less of them, which means I'm much more intentional when I do, which is really good. And then a lot of time in my evenings is taken up doing stuff for the show, finding photographers, messaging people. And it's, the feeling is different. My time is filled, but I'm using those tools rather than just to doom scroll and look at stuff and kind of wish that I owned something. I'm moving a project forward. And that feels really satisfying as a person. And it's also a great way to mark time. And then you can keep a little notebook, and you can have it, and you've got a work product that you've produced at the end of it.
I am a huge believer in boredom, as yeah. I already stated, and my kids too. I am actually pretty strict on screen time. Same. And when it's over, they'll be like, I'm immediately like, I'm bored. And they know I'll be like, good. Cause that's when you're going to be most creative.
Yeah,
that's when like my older two are going to grab something random and make a game out of it. Mm-hmm. Or like the things that they come up with. I mean, they've done chess mixed with this one game. We have this game called Space Escape. It's a collaborative game. I think we've played it as written like once, but they will take the pieces and all of a sudden they'll be playing chess mixed with Space Escape and have some sort of game they've created that they know the rules for and are playing it and having fun. And I'm just like, this is so cool. Like, if you guys weren't bored, there's no way you'd be innovating. And, you know, same with like Lego sets, or, I mean, my kids do a lot of reading too, or maybe they'll be bored and then they'll start doing like drawing contests. Mm-hmm. And the boredom is really what makes us be more creative. And so, yeah, when my kids say I'm bored, I'm like, okay.
Yeah, good.
I'm not your cruise director. Like, I'm not here to entertain you. Like, because because I don't want to constantly entertain my children. I don't, you know, back when I was in education school getting my master's, we had to read Neil Postman, who's brilliant. And he wrote like The End of Education. Did he write Entertaining Ourselves to Death or something like that? Anyway, he was warning about Sesame Street. I mean, he wrote in the 80s. He's warning that Sesame Street is too fast moving and is lessening kids' attention spans. And I'm like, what could you even say about things like Instagram or TikTok? And so I don't want my kids to be constantly entertained. That's not the goal.
Yeah.
The goal is, yes, we're going to make memories. We're going to do fun things. We'll have some screen time, but I want you to learn that sitting with your own thoughts isn't the scariest thing in the world. Sitting and having nothing to do or trying to figure out what to do with your time isn't terrible. And that is where you will learn more about yourself too, and be creative and take what's around you and mix things together that you would never do if I was just like, sure, play this, you know, video game all the time. So yeah, boredom. I think boredom is great for kids and adults, but as adults, we do have unfettered screen time.
Yeah, that's the problem. I think we kind of, you know, we ruin everything. We buy all the Lego sets, we buy all the toys because we're grown ups now and we can, you know. It's a shame, but that's why I'm so grateful to have found the project and to be able to connect with people and talk about stuff like this, because I think that's a good message to kind of put out into the world. One of the things, you know, everyone likes a little bit of gear. I was just curious, when you mentioned you were talking about shooting like 10 rolls of film a month, what were you shooting mostly with for your, what was your favorite camera to use? Because you've got a point and shoot. I don't shoot much film. I shoot instant film quite a lot because I maybe watched too many cartoons as a kid, so I don't quite have the patience to send it away. But yeah, I've got a point and shoot 35, but I don't have anything other than that. Everything else for me is digital, so I'm curious.
And I will be the first to admit, I do love gear, but I'm not a gearhead. Like, it's fun, especially with film. I say it's really fun to acquire new things because each camera has their purpose. And so when I'm packing for even like a weekend getaway, it can be really difficult to figure out what I want to bring because my instant camera has a different purpose than my Diana Mini, than my Nikon FE, than my Nikon F100, than, you know, my Pentax 645N. Like, they all have a different purpose, which makes it really fun. But I would say at that time, I was probably mostly shooting with my, which I would probably call this my favorite camera, would be my Nikon FE, just because I love how it's manual. Unfortunately, it does actually need a working battery in it, for reasons I don't understand, because the only thing it does is the light meter. So that is frustrating to think of, like, when the battery dies, like, I should just be able to use it, but I can't. But my Nikon FE, it is, because it is just fully manual, and I love the dials. I have a couple copies of it, and one of them, the focusing screen, has like a circle and the grids, and that has also helped me, like, if I'm trying to do multiple exposures, or I've done, like, one of my most favorite pictures I've taken was of the moon, and I ended up taking them in a circle. And I can talk about why I did that. That's also working within the constraints. But there's just something about that camera that I prefer to use. And I think it's just because of that manual connection.
You get exactly what you want. And a couple of your lenses, because we were talking about this beforehand, were those Nikon F-mount lenses, I assume. Yeah, yeah. So a 50 and a 24, is that right?
Yeah, I would say 50. Yeah. And they're, like, once again, not a gearhead. So it's like a 1.8, you know, like, I've somebody who was really into things like that would not just slap a 50 millimeter 1.8D on their camera, but I don't, that works for me. And same with the 24. And I think the reason why, I mean, I'm a prime lens girly. I will say that once I started with prime lenses, I just never looked back.
Same.
But I also think there's something about prime lenses and having the wrong lens on your camera that makes you think creatively. And creating within the constraints is also another way that we innovate. And so that the moonshot that I took is one of my favorite shots I've ever taken. And I was on a walk with a friend and I had my Nikon FE strung over my shoulder because I usually walk with a camera with my 50 millimeter lens on it. And we kind of got to the end of our walk and we had walked around this lake. And so she looks straight across the lake and she goes, "The moon." And I turned around and it was like the night before a supermoon, which I think the night before a supermoon is always the best because it's going to rise just enough earlier than the night of the supermoon or after. It's going to rise just enough earlier to be rising at dusk in the summer. You know, I mean, here the sun doesn't set till, you know, I'm north, I'm in Minnesota, so it doesn't set till super late in the summer. Yeah. And so the night before it was dusk and it was rising. So there's still like ambient light. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I knew I needed to photograph it. And I looked at my 50 millimeter lens and I'm like, this is like, if you were like, hey, person who likes to photograph the moon, what's your ideal lens? And if you're like, what's the worst lens you could have? I mean, they probably say 24 millimeter, but here I was like, I am like not the lens of choice. This is not what you would choose. And my friend's like, well, you can just go home and get another lens and come back. And I'm like, well, one, I don't really have a lens that I think is perfect. I have lenses that would be better. Hmm. But I'm like, two, it's dusk. And by the time I run home and come back, even though I live like, I don't know, it's like 5 minutes walking from the lake, I'm like, by the time I get home and come back, it is not going to look like this. And I want it to look like this. So I looked through my viewfinder and I saw the circle in the focusing screen. And I was like, that circle is about as big as the moon. Like that's the feel of the moon. Like it just felt like it took up the whole sky. And, you know, I look in that focus screen and I'm like, that circle takes up like almost the whole focusing screen. So I said, what can I do with these two? And so I decided to photograph a multiple exposure where I had the moon on, you know, kind of like every crosshatch. And then I tried to, you know, do it in that circle. And the result was so much cooler than what I would have taken with the appropriate lens, just because I'm not a particularly good, you know, I don't have the gear that would have been like, I can get really close to this and see all the little crevices. And I'm like, this is better than I would have done with my best fitting lens because I had the constraints. And I said, how can I make this work? And same with my 24 millimeter. I had that on my camera. I was on a bike ride and it was like just kind of the beginning of spring. And there was this magnolia tree blooming and I had my 24 millimeter lens on me. And I was like, this lens sucks for these blossoms. Like this is a bummer. And I was like, but I really want to photograph this because it just felt like, you know, when spring starts to awaken after a long Minnesota winter, there's just something that a photographer says, I need to capture this because this is a feeling. We wait all winter for this. And this is a magical moment. And so I was like, what do I do with this lens? And all of a sudden I realized, oh, if I take it off, I could freelance. And then it turns into like more of a macro situation where you have to get closer to your subject. And without that lens on, I ended up taking some of my like favorite images. And without that lens on, I wouldn't have thought creatively. And so sometimes having the wrong lens on your camera can force you to think in new ways.
Yeah, constraints are so key. Like you, I am a prime lens girly as well. That's partly why name it got in some ways is prime. Also, you're the perfect person to talk to, I realize, because it's prime lenses because 3 is a prime number. And so the whole idea of talk about 3 lenses, so it has layers. It's like a podcast dad joke onion of prime and 3, and I love prime lenses personally. I don't think at this point, after 13 years or whatever of shooting with primes, I don't know if I'd know what to do with a zoom lens if I had one again. Like, I think I'd just be It was a bit like the time I was in Wetzlar and they let me use a Leica Q, and I don't have any lenses as fast as 1.7. And so I just spent the whole day shooting things with shallow depth of field without thinking about it. It was like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. I'd spent so long thinking about whether I could. I only stopped to think about whether or not I should. And I was just like, there's a bit of cake. There's a bread. It's like giving me something that could shoot close focus macro and wide open when I'd spent all this time shooting with a rangefinder that can only focus down to like 70 centimeters. I was like, oh my goodness, this is the most incredible thing. Quick, look, there's a breadcrumb. And they're not worthwhile images, but it was fun. I was at play again, you know, that's sort of inspiring. So I love the idea of having a different tool and just making it work. And I think that's, again, going back to kind of the things we learn from kids, they don't know that no one's told them you shouldn't do that. They're not aware of the rules most of the time. So like just taking a lens and just seeing what you can do with it, I think that's great. And I think it's such an important thing for us all to remember. You know, we can get hung up on the correct way to do this. It's happened this week to Fuji. You've just released that medium format camera and everyone's looking at it going, why is it F4? It's going to be... And it's like, well, then don't buy it. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, someone at Fuji decided they would do an F4. Maybe they'll do an F2 net later and the lens will be better. Who knows? Seems pretty rad. If you've got, you know, also in the market of people about to buy a $6,000 camera... Nobody was harmed. Like, it's going to be fine. Those people will be okay. They know who they are. They know the person who wants that camera knows who they are, and they've probably already bought it. It's okay. The person who's the comment in the comments
section, you just like, can't scroll through that because everyone takes it personally. Sure. It's like nobody in the comment section realizes, "Oh, I could just like keep scrolling. This isn't like a personal attack on me.
I don't work for them." Like, if you work at Fuji, sure, maybe go and look at the comments, but then I'd encourage you not to. Like, you know, like, this is what's so lovely about making a podcast. There's no comment section. Like, I've only had nice messages because I think someone would have to put so much effort in to kind of, you know, I'm going to... Have you ever heard there's a really good Chris Rock bit about how all bullets should cost $5,000?
I have heard that,
yeah. Because like, you know, because then be like, you know, right, you've wronged me. I'm going to get a second job. I'm going to go and do it. And, like, and then I'm going to come back. And it would take the heat out of everything. But if somebody got shot, you'd be like, well, they must have done something. Because all bullets cost $5,000. But yeah, it's the creative version of that. Like, I need to create a high enough wall for you to get over that I have to mess up sufficiently. Mm-hmm. And that way we can avoid the badness.
It's the Polaroid model, really. It's saying, you know, we're going to make it really expensive to... shoot this, and so you maybe pay less on the front end. Anyone can consume it, you know, it's free to your podcast is free to consume, but in order to give you that negative feedback, the bar is high, and that is wonderful. It saves people from themselves, really.
There we go. What I'm doing is I'm helping them to help themselves.
Exactly.
How wonderful. Oh, brilliant. Well, this has been an absolute treat. I think for people who maybe have not come across your stuff before, where is the best place for them to get their fix of Amy Elizabeth and find out about Film Soup and the portrait course and all the fun stuff you do?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me. I mean, I do have a website, www.itsamyliz.com, itsamyliz.com. Or Instagram, same handle, It's Amy Liz, or Substack, same, or a Blue Sky, same handle, It's Amy Liz. And or you can also find me. I talk in people's ears too. My podcast is Post Processing, and it is basically just a way for me to talk because I like to talk. So put it out. And if you don't want to hear me talk, you don't have to listen. But those are the main ways to find me. And on my website, you will learn there's a link to Film Lab 135. There's a link to the Art Lab. You can get my 30 days of self-portraits guide, which is free. And so there's, you know, the website houses pretty much everything, I would say.
It's fantastic. I will say, great URL. It's Amy Liz is a really good one. And I like post-processing. I think, you know, how many episodes have you done? Is it like 17?
Something like that. Just about, maybe 17. Yeah, it's newer. Yeah.
Really cool. I love to meet other people making podcasts. Yeah. It's really nice.
That's fun. So I did want to ask you though, right quick. What is your impetus for taking self-portraits?
Well, I think it was maybe inspired a bit by seeing the exhibition last year, right? And seeing that thing that was sort of the history of, and realizing that self-portraiture, both in painting and photography, is kind of a tradition, first of all. So that's kind of interesting. And I think I'm quite a fan as well of using the camera I have, like the one you were talking about, is fully manual. So although mine's a digital, it's a Leica M, right? So it may as well be a film camera for all of the automation that's in it. It's got some remote trigger stuff and timing stuff and things like that, but like there's no autofocus. There's no, like, the bells and whistles are absent by design, which is one of the reasons I love using it. So the idea of using it for something like that is also, there's an extra wrinkle or an extra challenge. And I like that. I like the unconventional. I like the unusual. And so I think it kind of appeals to me on that level as a kind of a problem to be solved and a thing to learn from a craft and technical point of view. But then I think buried underneath that is a very personal sort of real, I'm aging. I think I've always worried about too much about how I look. And am I presentable? And how, what do people think of the way I look? And it's sort of an insecurity that goes back to being a teenager. And I definitely think growing up, when I grew up as a young man, it wasn't necessarily as acceptable or easy to talk about how you feel about the way you look in relation to others and things like that. And that sometimes is manifested in some unhealthy habits and things. So it's quite nice. I think the idea, as I'm very in my mid-40s now, and so the idea of like just getting comfortable in front of a lens myself will bring a comfort with me, for me, and then also I really like taking portraits and taking pictures of people, and I'm sometimes not brave enough. And I think if I've gone through some of that experience with myself, then I can start to help them to feel a bit more, I'm not asking anyone to do something I haven't done,
I feel like you, so I wrote a blog post or whatever about, in defense of self-portraits, and you basically like you outline like everything I talk about. So I feel like that you like totally tracking and like you have every good reason for wanting to embrace them. Because yeah, that is a time-honored tradition. You think of Van Gogh saying, I'm gonna try new techniques and new colors and I'm gonna use myself as a model. Or the introspective and just the validity. I think it's good. I think we, on Instagram they say show yourself in your feed because we want to know the person behind the art. And so connection, once again, connection. So I love that and I'm excited to, as you work through it, to just kind of hear how that all ends up going for you and what by the end has changed or stayed the same or what you might be asking for next and see is that a journey you're going to continue with or is it one where you're like okay yeah I did it like that's great but
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'd like to kind of, I tend to be about consistency and about repeated visits of things. So I feel like if I find, I'll find something in it, I expect, and then probably want to revisit it and come back to it and sort of do these sorts of things again. But I think the great power will be, I joke with people all the time, right? When I talk about taking photos, because someone will comment and say, oh, so, someone I work with who doesn't really engage with photography very often, and I'll send them some of my photos and they'll be like, oh, they're lovely photos. And I'll joke that, like, well, I've been trying to do it for 17 years. So if they weren't at least half decent at this point, it would be tragic. But I think a tree is an easy target, and outdoors and some of the landscape stuff I like to shoot a lot, they never, a squirrel never objects, a woodpecker never objects, right? Like, so I think that for me would unlock something, because I think I do aspire to take more pictures of people, and I don't think I'm as good at it. Like, the kids in the family are an easy target because they trust you and they know you and they've seen the results, and so it's fine. But I'd love to develop that confidence, and then when I get there, a bit like going on the route and going the walk over and over again, when I get there, to know what to do, because there's a few projects in my head that would depend upon capturing things in a more documentary style and a less kind of staged style. And so I think this is a good way to practice that on myself a little bit and sort of know what to look for and develop that muscle, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that is rad.
Yeah, isn't it? This whole thing's rad. It is. Thanks so much. I've loved it. It's been a great one.
I'm good.
Yeah. Well, have an amazing rest of day. I hope the film behind you does not engulf you and you send out everything you need to send out. And yeah, we'll hopefully send some folks your way.
Lovely. It was so good chatting with you, Ian.
Have a wonderful rest of day.
You too. Bye.
A huge thank you again to Amy for being my guest on the show this week. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget that you can like and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, Amazon Music, all the places. If you'd like, you can also leave us a review, which really helps us to float to the top in various places. And I'll start reading out reviews as they arrive in future episodes, because it's really fun getting that kind of direct feedback from listeners. You can also sign up to the weekly newsletter. That's available on ianfarrell.com/sign-up. And there's a link to that in the show notes as well. Oh, and lastly, you can support the show via Patreon if you'd like to. That's on patreon.com. Again, links in the show notes. Right, well, I'm off to take some photos and shove them in a pot with a load of juice from flowers and soup and see what comes out the other side. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.